KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I am an assistant professor of law at the Charlotte School of Law in Charlotte, North Carolina, as well as a non-resident fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on Hearsay Culture. Today, we're going in a slightly different direction than our typical show on Hearsay Culture. We are still going to be talking about technology, but we're going to be talking about technology and leadership. How does technology impact leadership skills and leadership values in organizations and amongst individuals? Our guest is a colleague of mine at Charlotte School of Law, Professor John Kunich. And John is a tenured professor of law at Charlotte. He's a prolific author, having written several books in the environmental law area. He has a JD from Harvard Law School. And additionally, to round out what is, and this cliche is used quite often, the Renaissance man, but I think I can call John a Renaissance man. He is also a professional poker player, as well as the both the lyricist and the writer of a musical based upon a highly regarded educator. So John's background is quite varied and quite interesting, and makes him what I think will be a very interesting guest for the show. Our focus today will be on his most recent book, Cub Fans Leadership Secrets, Learning to Win from a Cursed Team's Errors. John co-authored the book with Richard I. Lester, who will not be joining us today on the show, but for our purposes, I will refer to the book as John's. In Cubs Fan Leadership Secrets, and anyone who's a baseball fan could see initially where this is going, John uses the tortured history of the Chicago Cubs as a basis to do an inning-by-inning, literally, in nine chapters, analysis of different flaws and problems in the Cubs' organizational leaderships that led to their 100-year-plus deficit in World Series, even play, much less championships. Now, I am a Yankees fan, and we don't normally talk about the Yankees on this show. Were this a show about Boston Red Sox fans' leadership secrets, I would have a very difficult time trying to be an unbiased interviewer and journalist. In this situation, because we're dealing with the Cubs, I don't have a particular affinity for the White Sox, but I have no personal animosity towards the Cubs, and they don't play in the American League. So I'm not particularly concerned about my own ability to be non-biased in this discussion. However, White Sox fans and other fans in the National League East may not enjoy, or perhaps enjoy very much, discussing the failures of the Cubs over the past 100-plus years. But in this interesting book, what John has done is taken that experience and actually come up with concrete suggestions and analyses of what the Cubs did wrong, and then how organizations can take those mistakes and apply them for their benefit as opposed to their detriment in operating their organization, and how leaders themselves can learn from the mistakes of the Cubs. Today, we're going to be discussing this book in the context of technology, and in John's book, he does mention several times and discuss the impact of technology, both from a positive and negative perspective on organizations, and how organizations can harness technology in a way to improve their operations generally. Within that discussion, of course, are the tensions between newer generations, the millennials, as Morley Winograd and others have identified them, versus the older generations, how technology can perhaps be an impediment to operations, and what technology can do to the individual, both from a positive and negative standpoint in terms of information sharing and the use of it on a daily basis. So, with that introduction, I'm very excited to have John here in the East Coast studios of KZSU FM Stanford. John, thank you very much for joining me today on Hearsay Culture.
Oh, it's my pleasure, David. Thank you for having me.
John, what I always ask my guests and to start off is kind of talk a bit more about their background. So how did you get interested in leadership values, and how did you come to writing this book?
I spent 20 years as an Air Force officer. I was a JAG, like those Navy guys you see on TV, and as an Air Force officer and judge advocate, I had plenty of chances to exercise leadership and to have leadership exercised upon me. And I had examples, both good, bad, and indifferent, from my own experience and the experience of commanders I dealt with. And it occurred to me that there's some leadership lessons that could be learned from a very perverse example, a very unusual example that came from my own checkered past. That is, as a lifelong Chicagoan, the Chicago Cubs baseball team. Because I grew up in Chicago, I was a life. I became a Cubs fan at birth. It was a congenital defect. What could I say? And it's something that you never really overcome. There are support groups for many things, but there is no real effective cure for being a Cubs fan. And early on, I learned how to suffer, and I've never really looked back from that point. And having my heart broken repeatedly by the Cubs taught me a lot about how unfair life is and how many things can go wrong en route to a proverbial world championship. I decided finally to write a leadership book based on the examples the Cubs have provided over the last 100 years.
The Cubs have had this tortured history that baseball fans know quite well. And yet, as a Cubs fan, you had to force yourself to revisit this 100-year history. So I'm asking you this question from an author's perspective. How difficult was it to write this book?
It was extremely difficult. I lived through most of the horrific examples that I go into in the book. I lived through them, and I suffered along with the Cubs and along with their millions of fans. Incidents from 1969, 1984, I can hardly bear to speak the years, 1989, 2003, do I have to go on? And I realized, at one point I was tempted to just say, you know, if you don't know the history, look it up. I'm not going to tell it to you in the book. But then I said, no, that would be a cop-out. So I decided to risk going back into therapy again. Years, teams of Austrian psychiatrists down the tubes. I just said, I'm going to write about it. And so I went in with detail about each of those incidents, and I relived them. I got into the detail, and I said, how did this happen? Why did it happen? What could have happened differently to avoid this suffering for me, for the players, for the managers, for the millions of fans? What went wrong that we can learn from and turn this around? So I'll tell you, it was painful for me to write, and I'm sure for anyone who is a Cubs fan, it'll be painful to read. Not just because I'm a lousy writer, but because the subject matter is about the most horrific anyone can imagine. All those examples of things going wrong, snatching defeat from the jaws of victory again and again, I'll tell you, it's an example of learning from mistakes. And if any of you have ever made a mistake out there, you probably know that you learn the most in your life not from the times when things are going well and everyone's patting you on the back. The lessons that last, the lessons that stay with you are the times you made a horrible mistake, when you literally wince to think about those memories again, that it's so painful to recall that you just shrink from doing so. Those are the lessons that never go away, even if you wish they would. And because the Cubs have been the greatest treasure trove of mistakes of all time for the last century, there's no better place to turn to if you want a treasure trove of lessons learned from mistakes made.
The book is Cub Fans Leadership Secrets. John, let's talk a bit at this point about the overarching goal of the book and how you've structured it before we get into technology. So your background in focusing on leadership, I know it comes from your experience in the military. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about that and how that experience led you to reconceptualize perhaps those experiences in the context of the Cubs' history.
As an Air Force leader and as a follower of leaders in the Air Force, I learned that a lot of times people go through leadership as if it's a cookbook exercise, as if you could go through a checklist, a paint-by-numbers approach that's very much artificial, has nothing to do with how people actually respond to things in the real world. And a lot of times the Air Force, as well as other organizations I've been part of, will take some artificial framework, game plan, something that sounds interesting, and they'll go with it as if this is the answer to all of their problems, whether it's quality, total quality management, Six Sigma leadership, servant leadership, or anything else. It's sort of like liposuction leadership, I call it. It's like, let's do this easy, you know, rather than really dig deep and see where our own Achilles heels are and where our own flaws lie. let's do this nice and easy. We'll have a formula. We'll go through the motions. We'll prepare these documents. We'll sit around a circle and share some examples from our own lives about times that we had something like this happen to us. And then we'll go home at the end of the day and presto, we'll be great leaders. Well, that would be really nice if it worked. But, you know, the reason why there's hundreds of books on leadership sitting unread on shelves in bookstores and in libraries is that liposuction leadership doesn't really work all that great. It's quick and easy, and that's about the best you can say for it. So I decided, as a Cubs fan, I'm a realist. I know how unfair life is. I know how hard it is to succeed in the real world, and the Cubs have shown us every possible way to screw up. I figured if I could write a book chronicling and analyzing the myriad ways the Cubs have screwed up over the last century without a World Series championship, if my readers could just avoid making those errors, chances are whatever's left over will be pretty successful because the Cubs have done everything wrong that can be done wrong. Just eliminate those from your repertoire. You'll probably be a great success. So that's where the core idea came from.
It's this tortured history, I think, serves as a good way to perhaps begin our discussion of technology, because technology is one of those areas that can either be harnessed quite well by an organization or can become a detriment. One of the areas that you focus on in the book, and it's a good way to start off, I think, is how technology can be used to identify and develop talent. And you know, this is a controversial area in technology anyway, because we know from examples of using mathematics that can be useful. And I think, you know, Moneyball, you know, the very well-known book about how the Oakland A's, speaking of baseball, used mathematics to predict people that were not apparently high performers, who would be high performers in baseball. But we can also see the overuse of technology, where we perhaps rely too much on non-human, as it were, factors in doing these analysis. Now, as technology develops, we're able to create technologies that allow computers to even begin to reason and think and learn from mistakes. But let's put that aside for a moment and talk a little bit about this history. How has technology up to now been used in ways that you think are effective to identify talent in an organization?
Well, in answering that question, I'm going to have to avoid talking much about the Cubs because they haven't done it. And that's one of the problems. The A's are a good example of how you can use technology as one tool amongst many to identify and cultivate promising young talent, often in surprising areas. The Cubs, until very recently, have done virtually none of that. One of the reasons is, one of the flaws of the Cubs is that they've been so rooted in tradition and history, they're literally drowning in it, and it takes a tremendous amount of force to overcome that kind of century-long inertia. As you point out, some teams like the A's, the Dodgers, and others have been very good at using metrics, body strength, the ratio of fat to muscle, the muscle structure, the mechanics of a pitching motion, to identify people who are likely to have career-ending injuries, people who have surprising amount of strength and excellent eye-hand coordination that wouldn't readily be apparent. There's all sorts of skills involved in baseball, the famous five tools of hit with power, run, field, and throw, that you can get a pretty good handle on through a variety of physical measurements, which of course can then be analyzed through all sorts of software. By no means is that the be-all and end-all, but it's a useful tool to add to your arsenal. Better to have it than not. At least then you can factor it into your decision-making, as opposed to not having it and strictly relying on the old-fashioned coach who barnstorms around the country drinking heavily and occasionally sobers up long enough to observe a baseball game at the minor league level. That's pretty much been the Cubs paradigm, and that misses out on a whole additional area of information, a whole additional source of data that can make all the difference in identifying and retaining the right young talent. one reason the Cubs have gone an entire century and counting without a World Series championship is their farm system has been among the worst in baseball, despite the vast financial resources they've had available to them, as opposed to, say, the Dodgers and the Yankees, who are always bringing up promising young talent, and they hold on to the right ones more often than not. For the most part, the Cubs have had to go into the free agent market, trade for players in mid-career, get the expensive proven talent as opposed to the inexpensive brand new talent that's first coming up, and that's cost them a whole lot in terms of money as well as missed opportunities from the early years of a player's career and missing out on the opportunity to inculcate the organization's values in the player from the very beginning to make them bleed Dodger blue like Tommy Lasorda used to say. You can't do that if somebody's already been through the minor league system of another team and spent their first several years in the majors on another team's roster. They come at you in mid-career as a known quantity that you really can't remake in your own image. So those are a lot of missed opportunities that the Cubs have had.
You mentioned in your book the storied deal of Lou Brock, which again, I because we're doing this recording in the East Coast studios, I can look at you and it almost feels like I'm waterboarding in the sense that I have to mention these things to a Cubs fan, and so I apologize for some of these questions. But you take an example like the Lou Brock deal, which I'll summarize for the listeners as basically being the Cubs dealing someone who turned out to be a Hall of Fame player very early in his career before he had displayed the Hall of Fame ability and got virtually nothing in return for that player. Again, my apologies, John, for this has probably been one of those interviews that would have been easier to do by telephone, so I wouldn't see the reaction. But let's step back and use that example more broadly to delve the following question. To what do you attribute, from a technological standpoint, the inability of organizations to harness technology in ways that would allow for the identification of a talent like Lou Brock? I mean, is it something as simple as the general reticence of people that are not as familiar with technology to embrace it? Is there a skepticism about it? I know that there are a variety of factors, but perhaps what are two or three top factors that come to mind that create this scenario where organizations don't use this technology effectively?
To some extent, it's a generational situation where people from the younger generation grew up with computers. It's second nature to them to use software, to be sophisticated with the various tools available from technology. The people who came around decades earlier often are not familiar and not comfortable with them, and they have to be dragged kicking and screaming into using them in any way and will never be fully comfortable and at ease with using them. To some extent, it's also a cultural thing. If you're from an organization, a way of life, a profession that doesn't use a lot of technology, it'll again be foreign to you. Baseball people, managers, coaches, typically are former players themselves, whether successful or not, whether major league level or not. They were players, and they did what players do. They practiced, they trained, they exercised, they partied at night. They weren't typically computer savvy folks. These aren't the guys you found in the library late at night, frankly. They were out partying, playing, and exercising. And that got them where they are, and very successfully in many cases. But they weren't computer nerds, unless they were really peculiar. And so they don't come from that culture. It's foreign to them. The organizations they came from didn't value it. The people they hung out with didn't, culturally. And typically they're from a generation that didn't embrace it. For all those reasons, it's a very new phenomenon, even for organizations that are more enlightened and successful than the Cubs, which is to say all of them. It's still quite rare to see technology used effectively and to its full potential in baseball.
We're talking with John Kunich, co-author of the book Cub Fans Leadership Secrets, recently published. John, when we talk about technology in organizations, and I think this is a topic that requires more analysis, as you mentioned, the younger that employees get, the more familiar generally they're going to be with technology and the more comfortable. I can only imagine what my 2-year-old son, Noah, or your children that are older, will expect from technology when they enter the workforce. But as we look at it today in 2009, it does seem like, and I think it's fair to say, this is not a profound statement, that more and more workers will expect more and more technology. Is that a fair statement? On the surface, it seems correct, but are we right in assuming that organizations uniformly must use more and more technology to be successful? What's your view on that?
I think it's artificial to assume that more is always better in any field, including the use of technology. As a law professor, I know that sometimes there's pressure to use more technology in your classroom teaching under the theory that it's always better to use more than less. But I think it has to always be employed judiciously. Is it really going to add value to employ a computer, a graphic, a visual aid, something involving tech? Or am I just doing it because I can? It's sort of a show-offy type idea. I think whether you're a professor or a manager at any level or a leader of government or a church group, you always have to ask yourself, am I using technology because it really is going to make a positive difference that I can't derive elsewhere? Or am I doing it because somebody is forcing me to, because I think I have to, or because it's a new toy that I just want to play with? We don't want to do anything just because we have to. We want to do it because it's better, faster, cheaper, better than the alternatives. And I think that's where a lot of organizations fall down, because it requires a little extra thought to come up with a faster, cheaper, better way of looking at things, rather than just say, all right, everybody do it. Everyone's going to use technology 3 times per hour. That's it. Next subject. You know, that's quick and easy. It's just stupid.
How much of technology, in your view, from a leadership standpoint, involves this kind of showmanship? I think we certainly see today, as you know, as we've discussed, as there are a large number of leadership books and you know, 1-minute manager type books that are out there of varying quality. How much of technology falls under the same rubric in your mind? In other words, are organizations using technology or purport to be using technologies in ways that ultimately cover up a lack of understanding about that technology?
I think it's a lot like my concept of liposuction leadership. A lot of people have as their main goal in life to not get fired and to look good to their boss. And if your boss is somebody who focuses on things like technology, or if they're easily impressed by bells and whistles because they don't understand them, one easy way to sort of preserve your job, keep your position secure, and score some brownie points with the boss is to have something on your computer screen, have some device in your hand when you go to a meeting that impresses them, almost like a talisman to a primitive person. Here I have the power of computers. And oh, they bow before you. Yes, tell me, oh great one, how can I make my life better? I will tell you in 10 years, but first I need that long-term contract. And you can slow roll things like that. Anything that looks impressive, that's flashy, for people who don't know any better, that can be very persuasive. Oh, I better not fire them. They are important. They know stuff that I don't know. And so I think that happens quite a lot, especially when you have the older and old school type managers trying to supervise the young guns who know how to make things look good, whether or not they're actually accomplishing much.
The book itself takes this structure that goes through 9 innings, and a couple of those particular areas, I think, seem to have a technology-heavy focus. But I'm curious, of the areas where you didn't mention technology explicitly, or the chapters you didn't mention technology explicitly, are there any that you look at, or as we think about it today, have an element of technology that perhaps would be an explanation for your next book?
Well, my last chapter, dealing with fatal flaws, Achilles' heels, I think, I list about 50 different tragic flaws that people tend to be afflicted with that bring them down despite maybe otherwise great gifts, wonderful talents, tremendous abilities. But there's one thing that is their weakness that tends to hit them again and again and undermine everything else. And I don't believe I listed technological illiteracy or lack of tech savvy as one of those Achilles heels, but I think it belongs there, and that could be worth exploring in my next book. I think a lot of people, including the Cubs and many older organizations that are sort of stuck in the past and not very comfortable with or fluent in the language of the modern tech era, they have that as an Achilles heel because it sort of makes them like a dinosaur right around the time of the extinction spasm of 65 million years ago. Oh, snap, here comes the meteor. What do you do with a meteor? I don't know. It looks like another sun. Oh, wait, it's crashing. They don't know what to do, and they can be left in the dust when everyone else has the tools available to overcome a sudden change in circumstances like the economic collapse of late 2008 continuing on into 2009. Some organizations are relatively flexible, able to use these tech tools to make the best of a bad situation. Others just go bye-bye, and they become the subject matter of the latest government bailout because they're helpless, sort of like a cub, a newborn mammal, blind at birth, totally defenseless, clumsy, available for any predator to snap up. Any wonder why naming a team after such a being would never win a World Series in 100 years? Hello?
Yeah, it the name itself certainly doesn't conjure the right image. And I guess as a Yankee fan, Yankee has totally, at least in the United States, has a very different perspective, I suppose, with the internationalization of baseball. That could change based upon perspective. We're talking with John Kunich, co-author of the book Cub Fan Leadership Secrets, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways that you can make a donation to KZSU in these lean times. You can go to KZSU's webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU, or you can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, and you will get, hopefully, a very enthusiastic and quick response from our underwriting department. Regardless, I do hope that you continue to keep listening to KZSU and to Hearsay Culture. So John, everything that we're talking about with technology, I think, goes to the issue of the changing technology that exists. And of course, you know, it's a cliche that, you know, today's popular technology won't be popular, you know, a week from now, 6 months from now, a year from now. But we're in a point of transition, with regard to technology itself and how organizations use technology. Do you think that vis-a-vis leadership, that there can come a time where we understand the elements of technology from a leadership standpoint such that we would be able to adapt to any new technology? Or is the nature of technology and leadership such that we're going to need more and more books like Cub Fans Leadership Secrets that require us to figure out what to do with this new world?
I think there is a permanent solution at the heart of this, but it's not an easy one, like most permanent solutions tend to be. It's darn difficult to actually achieve it, but I think if you can cultivate in your leaders a mindset of being a perpetual learner, somebody who really is open to new things, who reads voraciously and widely, who isn't just narrowly focused, stuck in his or her office, never reads anything but the local professional journals and business journals that are in their own specialty, but is truly a Renaissance person, like you so kindly called me, who's willing to read and to talk to others, including people that they usually wouldn't socialize with, it, to talk to young folks, to talk to the IT people, and see what's out there. If you take that attitude, like, I'm always able to learn something new, I'll look for something that'll help me do my job wherever it comes from, even things that I'm unfamiliar with and maybe not comfortable with, then you have the best possible chance of staying current, always being at the right point in the power curve and not left in the dust. It's just a mindset that makes you teachable and open to new things. I like to occasionally just go to a store, a nice big software store or an internet site, and I look around aisle by aisle, row by row, and just see what products are out there in every category, including productivity, education, games. And I'm always amazed by what I see. There's usually something that I pick up that's useful in my own life and in my own career, just from browsing around and seeing what's new in the last 6 months. The field's moving so fast. I think if everyone would at least do that, they'd be better off. They'd learn what's the cutting edge product of the day. And maybe, I hate to say it, take a geek to lunch once in a while. Let them tell you. They'll be so enthusiastic that an actual human would take them to lunch that they'll tell you all about the exciting new things that they have on their radar screen. And once in a while, you never know when it's going to happen. You just might learn something, and it could be something that'll be helpful to you and your organization.
The one of the challenges, I think, of anyone that consumes technology and that uses technology to harness information, of course, is the preponderance of information out there. And this is, you know, again, a topic that's been widely written about from everything from physiological perspectives in the case of Gary Small's iBrain to rhetorical or even economic viewpoints and from Richard Lanham's Economics of Attention. All of these books dealing with the question of how we go about as human beings using this vast quantity of information in meaningful ways. There's a separate line of books that have been written about how libraries operate from the perspective of the internet and how we could learn from even ancient libraries. So my question for you is, how does an organization cultivate leaders and allow them to be voracious readers when we have a ridiculous amount of information coming at us that, of course, no human being, no matter how smart or how efficient, could possibly comprehend and get into without going insane? How does an organization do this work?
For many decades, famously, the Chicago Cubs in beautiful ivy-covered Wrigley Field were the only team in all of the major leagues not to have lights installed for night baseball. They were the last man standing. No night baseball at Wrigley Field. Why? Well, it's tradition. Baseball's meant to be played under God's sunshine. The neighbors might complain because there'll be beer-drinking barbarians stepping on their their posies at nighttime when they stumble home to the L. And so no lights. And why? Well, there was no real good answer for it. And predictably, the Cubs would wilt in late summer under the ungodly heat of Wrigley Field. They would do very well the first couple of months of the season. June, July, they start to wilt. August, September came the predictable annual collapse, largely because they were so tired from playing under 90-degree heat in the daylight at Wrigley Field. It took forever to undo that mindset. And I think that's a lesson that the organizations across the board need to learn. It's not a waste of time to look at something new, like maybe lights, like everyone else has. Maybe everyone else is using software and computers and they're coming up with tech tools that make life easier and more productive. Maybe they're not all wrong, and maybe it wouldn't be a waste of time to learn something about that. But so many old school mentality types say any form of training, any form of taking time out and learning, maybe having a retreat, maybe having a field trip to the local software store, maybe having an hour where the tech guys come in and talk to us about current developments, is a waste. They refuse to sharpen the saw, as Steve Covey says. You gotta sharpen the saw at some point, or it becomes duller and duller, and it's harder and harder to get the job done. But it's always tempting for certain types to say, no, we can't take time out for doing that. We're too busy. We're already behind. Press on. Keep sawing. But it's dull. I don't care. Saw harder. Saw faster. And they never take the time out to maybe do a paradigm shift. Now, sometimes paradigms don't need to be shifted, but I've met a lot of paradigms in my life, and I'm here to tell you some of them need shifting. You'll never shift them unless you take a little time out from your daily grind to reassess the situation. See what you're doing that might not be completely optimal and find some better way.
We're talking with the subdued John Kunich, author of the book Cub Fans Leadership Secrets, here on KZSU's Hearsay Culture. You know, one of the interesting things you pointed out that I had never thought about in the famous Bartman debacle. Yes, and again, Mr. Bartman was the infamous Cub fan of earlier in this century who arguably interfered with a catchable ball that led to I'm sorry, John. That led to yet another year of failures by the Cubs. One of the things you pointed out with respect to Mr. Bartman, who I thought I had read, actually had to leave Chicago as a result of this episode, was that he was wearing headphones when he allegedly interfered. You could definitely tell this story better than me, but I found it interesting that, again, we could argue that technology interfered with his ability to concentrate there. Of course, that is a bit of surmise on my part. But perhaps you could tell the Bartman story in the context of if we can draw any lessons at all, even anecdotal lessons, from this particular factoid that he was wearing headphones at that crucial moment.
Let me take a moment to compose myself. Thank you for reminding me of that again. Oh, I was in the 2003. It was in the 2003 divisions league championship series. The Cubs had actually won round one of the playoffs that year, defeating the Atlanta Braves in the division series, and the Cubs had won 3 out of the first 4 games of the league championship series against the Florida Marlins. They were ahead with 5 outs to go in game 5 with one of their 2 ace pitchers, Mark Pryor, on the mound, pitching brilliant shutout baseball. The vendors outside Wrigley Field had been given the green light to start unwrapping the championship, National League champion, T-shirts, banners, and all sorts of souvenirs. The Cubs were finally going to go to the World Series for the first time since 1945 and maybe have a shot at winning their first one since 1908. But then, one guy reached first, still no problem. Mark Pryor was pitching brilliantly. But then the batter hits a foul ball down the left field line, and the Cubs left fielder Moises Alou drifts over, and it looks like he's got a legitimate shot at catching it, but the ball's drifting to the stands, and Moises leaps up to glove the ball, and unfortunately, a Cubs fan, later identified as Steve Bartman, reaches for the same ball because it's in the vicinity of his front row seat there in the left field foul line area, and he deflects the ball away from Alou, and it's really just another foul strike. The batter hadn't reached base. It's just a foul ball. But Alou went ballistic. He flung his glove to the ground and screamed in agony at the fan. Mark Pryor, the pitcher on the mound, began shouting, "Fan interference! Fan interference!" Dusty Baker, the manager, could have taken control of the situation right then and calmly walked to the mound and told Mark Pryor, "Look, we're ahead 3-0. There's a guy on first. There's one out. It's just a strike. Get the guy out. Double play. We're out of the inning. Then 3 more outs. We're going to the World Series, baby." But no, Dusty stays in the dugout, spewing profanity, just cursing fate that once again some idiot has conspired to destroy the Cubs. Sure enough, all hell breaks loose. I won't go into detail, but let me tell you this. Of all the things that can break loose in your life, all hell is not a good one. And pretty soon, the Cubs had gone from 3-0 ahead to down by several runs. They went on to lose game 5 as well as the following game, and the rest is history. What happened was that Bartman was wearing these headphones while he's watching the game. And maybe you've seen this in your own career. Somebody at the office is trying to multitask, which means basically they're goofing off and pretending to be working extra hard. Instead of watching the game that's right in front of him, he's got a front row seat at the playoffs. He's watching the game and listening to something on his headphones. Now, maybe it was a play-by-play. What? He's too stupid to understand? Hey, the batter just swung at that pitch. Really? I didn't think he swung. Yeah. Hey, that was a home run. No kidding. I missed it. I was too busy adjusting my radio. Hang up and drive. Throw the radio away and watch the game. But he's multitasking, and maybe that distracted him enough that whatever brains he was born with weren't active enough for him to say, maybe I shouldn't reach for this ball because it looks like my guy, my left fielder, is going to catch this ball. Maybe I shouldn't stop him from doing that. Instead, he's distracted, and the ball falls helplessly to the pavement, and the rest is history.
You know, it brings to mind a much more mundane scenario, but one that I've seen in my own experience the last couple of years, which is people that are devout users of technology have begun to not bring their technology to meetings or to conferences and so forth because they find the computer and all of its abilities too distracting, and they ultimately are not paying attention to what's going on. So some of the people I know who are amongst the most devout people I know to technology have stopped using technology at any point where they need to concentrate on someone else. Obviously, they're using it in their own work. But it does lead us to this issue of distraction with technology itself. Yeah, again, it would be cliche to say that, that we don't want excess of anything, and technology perhaps is no different. But again, how does an organization balance these competing factors? I mean, whether you're a teacher in a classroom, and something I've struggled with as a professor is whether I should shut off the internet, even though I teach internet law, whether I should shut off the internet. And I've opted against doing it primarily because I think at the end of the day, I want to make a class that's as interesting as possible. And if someone chooses to surf the net, that's their choice. I'm concerned, however, about the fact that not only is that person not learning, but also they could be distracting others. How does an organization balance this issue of harnessing technology but not using it to distraction?
It's like Pandora's box. Once you open it, you really can't shut it again. Schools, businesses have spent millions of dollars making their organizations wireless, internet friendly, having the best possible computers, access at every workstation to all manner of technological marvels. And then they find people don't always use them for officially sanctioned purposes. Sometimes they surf the net, they look at unapproved websites while in class or on the job, they'll send personal emails, they'll do Facebook while they're at work, they'll do eBay. I mean, not that I would ever do any of that, but I've heard rumors that such things happen. Mm-hmm. And what do you expect? These are powerful tools. They're very enticing. They have all sorts of wonderful capabilities, many of which lend a great deal of joy and richness to our lives. When you put those in front of anybody, whether it's on a BlackBerry or a cell phone or a laptop or a notebook computer or a desktop, they're going to use it. And there's a tremendous temptation. I agree with Oscar Wilde, the only way to get rid of a temptation is to yield to it. You know, if you've got those temptations, you can't shut it off. You can't close Pandora's box. Let it rip. You know, let them do it. You can lovingly encourage people to focus on the subject matter at hand, but you can't really compel them not to use the tools that are available. Of course, if they're violating the law by downloading pornography, you can intervene in that respect. But if they're just doing some occasional personal stuff, chances are, if it's not excessive, it's going to make them happier and more productive. I just say, let it happen. I know in my own classes, some students are using the computers to send instant messages to one another, or they're checking out websites that have nothing to do with what we're talking about. I usually just let it go unless it gets to be truly a distraction, feeling that on balance, there's no better way of handling it than simply to ignore it unless it really gets excessive.
We're talking with John Kunich, author of the book Cub Fans Leadership Secrets. John, we have about 10 minutes left, and there was an area of a particular interest that I thought is something we should talk about. You in one point in the book, it's the only point in the book, you actually throw some math at us with something that you've coined the coefficient of panic vulnerability. My question is first, what is that? And you point out, and perhaps we could discuss, how information technology itself can help an organization deal with this CPV. So, of course, it requires a definition of CPV, and then how can technology deal with those issues?
I came up with this concept called coefficient of panic vulnerability, or CPV for short, as just a way of conceptualizing how an individual or an organization becomes more or less vulnerable to cracking under pressure. Famously, infamously, the Cubs have cracked under pressure more times than I care to mention, and I became interested in why that happens. Are they particularly vulnerable because of certain features that are present in the organization? Are there things that a leader can do to root out, identify, and exterminate those characteristics, those tendencies that make a team more susceptible to folding in the clutch? So I looked at the factors, and really it doesn't have to be mathematical, but I thought by making a formula out of it, it helps us to conceptualize the interrelationship of several factors that have some influence on whether we're cool under pressure or apt to crack like an egg at the first sign of a dark cloud, like the Cubs. And so I came up with things that include past experience, both good and bad, at dealing with emergencies. Obviously, a lot of people have been exposed to difficult situations, and we take away from that either a traumatic experience that makes us shrink from ever encountering it again, or we become battle-hardened veterans. We're more used to it. We're not as flustered because we've dealt with it before. Those are factors you need to look at. You also need to look at the tendency of teams and organizations to train realistically based on worst-case scenarios, the real problems they're likely to face, as opposed to just Mickey Mouse make-work type training. Do they make training hard and meaningful and realistic? The more you can prepare people for the crises that might materialize, like a dropped foul ball late in an important postseason game, the more likely you're not going to fall apart when it happens because, well, it's like a fire drill. I've been here before. All right, what do I do? Stop, drop, and roll. Let's stick with what's gotten us this far. That's much more feasible if you've trained like you work, trained like you fight, trained for the real deal. Introducing into your organization experienced people with the right experience. You may not have on your team people who've already weathered the storm within your organization, but maybe you can acquire some. In baseball, you trade for them or you acquire free agents. In business, you might lure somebody over with the right package who's got some scars on her back from dealing with a crisis. They know how to get through it. We bring them on to train the rest of us and to provide basically a rock of Gibraltar and a tower of strength to everyone so that when times get tough, they can show us the way. These and other factors are factored into this thing I call CPV just so we can demystify it a little bit, understand that it's not just some bizarre, unsolvable mystery out there, but there are factors that increase or decrease our vulnerability to folding under pressure. Once we understand that, we have a chance to make a difference and move ahead in a positive direction.
John, we have about 5 minutes left in our discussion, and I think here's where we can take kind of a crystal ball look. These are uniformly questions that I often ask of guests, and I caveat them by saying that they're unfair questions because I'm asking you to pull out the crystal ball and do some prognosticating. But as you look at organizations' abilities to adapt to technology, how confident are you, especially today? I mean, we're recording this interview on June 4th, 2009. The government has recently become a majority owner of General Motors. We own the largest insurance conglomerate in the world, in AIG. Between now and the time that this show airs in July, for all we know, other major businesses will become owned by the government in small or large part. These concepts, the idea of government owning GM were unthinkable perhaps even a year ago. So how do you think organizations are going to be developing and dealing with technology in the coming few years? And perhaps I'll put out this point of 5 years, assuming that the economy does recover as seems to be predicted. How do you see organizations harnessing technology for better or for worse?
For those that aren't already taken over by the government, I think they're going to say, what are the lessons learned we can derive from this catastrophe that keep us out of the government's clutches? How can we avoid being taken over by Uncle Sam ourselves? And as they look, if they're honest about it, if they really say, let's take a no-holds-barred approach to this and look at our own weaknesses, our own Achilles heels, they can realize that technology may play a role in helping them to get ahead of the power curve, to keep up and even surpass the competition, to not be always behind the trends, but maybe be a trendsetter. They have to do that, or else they're very likely to be amongst the many who don't survive, who don't retain their independence. For those that are taken over by the government, I know from 20 years of government service that the government's not the best place for innovation to flourish. It's often rooted in the way things have always been. The cliche, close enough for government work, is widely spoken. That's how it got to be a cliche. There's a sort of a tendency not to innovate, not to take chances, to just stick with what's always worked. And that causes me to fear that unless that paradigm gets shifted, all these businesses that have been taken over by the government aren't likely to really ever get out of that situation, because the government famously is inefficient and not proactive.
So as a Cubs fan, you are taking a somewhat bleak view of the possibilities of organizations to deal with these issues.
As a Cubs fan, I take a bleak view of all of creation.
John, as I mentioned, and I think in the last couple of minutes here, I did want to mention this. You are a professional poker player, and you've actually appeared in a World Series of Poker. As what is the name that you use for yourself, or how have you been named?
The Nutty Professor.
And that means what exactly?
I'm crazy.
Yeah,
exactly. And I'm a professor.
Yes, and I've seen the pictures. I mean, I'm not revealing anything that hasn't been made public, but perhaps you could describe your moniker and how you actually appear in the World Series of Poker.
Well, at the 2008 World Series of Poker main event, I went dressed as the old-time comic Stan Laurel, complete with a derby hat. And I've got this little rubbery creature with sort of a smiley wolf face on him, called Wiggly Creature. He comes with me and he does all my talking for me at the table through me as sort of his ventriloquist. For some reason, people look at me and Wig, the strangest pair of fraternal twins in history, and say, those guys are nuts. And he's a professor? Hence the term Nutty Professor. This year at the main event, I'll be going as a Cubs fan. I'll be wearing my Cubs uniform, and Wig will be wearing a miniature Cubs fan Barbie doll jersey himself. So be watching for us on the broadcast.
I think that there's probably no better way to close an interview than putting this image of a law professor dressed as a Cub fan with a puppet Cub fan with them at the World Series of Poker. And so on that note, I'll merely ask the last question, which is, you have your book, Cubs Fan Leadership Secrets. You've also written several previous books. What is your next project, and how can people learn more about your work?
My next book, the sequel to Cubs Fans Leadership Secrets, is a book called Betting the Earth, How We Can Still Win the Biggest Gamble of All Time. And I draw from my experience as a poker player and an environmental attorney to see how we can use probabilities, odds, uncertainties to work through some of the biggest environmental challenges this planet's ever faced, including climate change, global warming, mass extinction, all sorts of cheery topics like that. You wonder why I'm never invited to parties?
The book is Cub Fan Leadership Secrets. The author is John Kunich. John, thanks for coming in and joining us on Hearsay Culture and discussing this really interesting topic in a book that I think is colorfully written and fun to read. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Dave.
I'm looking forward to a number of interesting upcoming guests here on Hearsay Culture for this summer quarter. Among them will be Professor Paul Heald from the University of Georgia. Georgia, as well as Kevin Bankston from the Electronic Frontier Foundation. Jamie Boyle from Duke University Law School will be on discussing his book on the public domain. Michael Geis from the University of Ottawa will be on as well. Professor John Taranian from Chapman University School of Law will be on discussing his book involving race issues and technology. Michael Heller from Columbia University will be on as well as Susan Merritt from San Jose State, who's written or edited a compendium of essays on government secrecy. I'm also looking forward down the road to having on, among others, Professor Siva Vaidyanathan from the University of Virginia, discussing his book, The Googleization of Everything. Kazis Varnellis and Geert Lovink will be on discussing their philosophies of technology. Alex Halavay from Quinnipiac University discussing his fascinating book, Search Engine Society, as well as Gordon Hull from the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, discussing philosophy and technology, and Wendy Chun discussing her book involving race identity and technology itself. As always, you can listen to the show a variety of ways. You can listen to the show, of course, on KZSU FM Stanford at 5 p.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays by tuning in the old-fashioned way in the Bay Area, or by streaming at kzsulive.stanford.edu, or you can subscribe to our podcast either through the Stanford Center for Internet Society's webpage through iTunes, and you can subscribe there, or by going to CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. Last but not least, you can go to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all of the previous almost 90 shows at this point, plus see the upcoming schedule and read occasional blog entries and comments and so forth. I'm always interested in hearing your feedback, suggestions for future topics, and anything else you'd like to share relating to the show by emailing me at dave@hearsayculture.com. Again, that's dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you again for listening to Hearsay Culture. I hope you've enjoyed the show. And please stay tuned to KZSU-FM for more diverse programming. Have a great day.